Garrett Edelstein here, your celeb expert and your celeb savant. Celeb Savant is a weekly entertainment show. We have long-form career retrospective type interviews with celebrities, singers, actors, and industry experts. Shack Attack have enjoyed a level of success and career longevity rarely paralleled in contemporary music. Because of the nature of their music, their fan base is one that is far-reaching while always retaining an underground element. This paradox sees a band who are known primarily as serious jazz or funk musicians enjoying both high cult status and instant recognition as a household name. After a number of successful top 20 singles in the UK, the band went on to score unprecedented international success with the release of the classic Nightbirds recording, and the title track has now become a standard in the popular music repertoire. This success was repeated with top 10 hit Down on the Street, and the award-winning video established the band's personnel of Jill Sayward, Bill Sharp, Keith Winter, George Anderson, and Roger Odell. With the Magic Al Jarreau Shack Attack combination, the group went on to record the track Day by Day to further international acclaim. Along with this successful recording career, Shack Attack had firmly established themselves as a vibrant live act, combining astute musicianship with a sense of fun that communicated strongly with the worldwide audiences. Their performance in Japan's Budokan Hall won them a silver award at the Tokyo International Song Festival. Other awards include the Best Instrumental Album for 6 consecutive years, and other live concerts of note have been the East Meets the West Border Concert at the time of the German reunification and the open-air concert in Cape Town for the Millennium Celebrations, where they played in front of 250,000 people. Shack Attack perform regularly in the UK, Europe and the Far East and release CDs almost annually. There are also DVD releases available, proving there's still an insatiable demand for the unique Shack Attack sound. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Jill Sayward from Shack Attack. Where do we find you in the world? What's happening in your life?
Okay, a couple of days ago, I arrived back into my hometown, which is in Sardinia. I'm in a place called Martis in Sardinia, and it's a little village in the middle of nowhere, and no traffic, no people, just sheep and countryside, and it's my paradise. Wonderful.
So are you the only people living there?
In this area, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Me and my partner. And we did one of these things where you buy a derelict house and renovate it. And
okay.
Go through all the traumas. It was a similar, in fact, we should have videoed the whole thing because it was quite horrific, a lot of it, you know. But now we have a beautiful, very, very old house and just countryside and mountains and sheep.
No offense to anyone listening. No humans is the best.
I think as you get older, you realise you don't need so many humans in your life, just a few that really matter. And you dedicate all of your time and love to them, and that's all you need.
I've often said I'm an alien from another planet, being sent down to this planet so I can go back to my planet and tell them what not to do.
Yeah, I hear that. I think we're of the same mentality. You know, we have the same sort of thing. And sometimes I feel like I have landed into, especially when I'm in shopping malls and things, I walk around thinking, what's this about? I don't understand why are people doing this. You know, I do feel like an ape, definitely.
So, Jill, let's rewind. Let's go back to the beginning of your journey into the entertainment industry. So at what age did you decide, cool, this is my path? And then how did that evolve into the journey with Shack Attack?
My goodness me, you're going back a long way here. But be careful, incriminate myself. But yeah, I mean, I started at 14, 15 years old professionally. Okay. I was at school, but they were unaware that I was touring. You know, I got into a lot of trouble with it, but I was doing gigs and going back to school in the morning. So it was a jazz rock band called Fusion Orchestra.
Okay.
And we were pioneers because although I was very young, I had this vision of being something completely different to a female vocalist in a rock band. I made myself very pretty, very, very flowery and singing with guts and, you know, aggression. And it was unusual because most of the girl rock singers at that time were jeans, looking hard, like Joplin thing, you know, very macho. So I broke the mold, and of course as a result of that, the stage act evolved. It became very well known for being quite explicit at times, but it was quite revolutionary. And of course the music, the album was a concept album, a long sort of heavy rock album, which did very, very well, and it saw us on the road for about 5 years. No, and we had a deal with EMI, so we were backed up, and then it just fizzled out in the end. You know, band members left, and I got fed up with it and thought, I'm not really a heavy rock singer. I want to sort of do something else and move on. So that's where it started. And then I moved into gigging with different bands, and then gigging with a band called the Northern Lights, who were a huge ensemble in London that did cover shows in these places called Mecca, which they were dance places where you all gather, and big band, like an Earth, Wind and Fire, a full brass, everything you can imagine. And that was amazing because I did my apprenticeship there, really, because we also did cover albums, which were these cheap albums you could buy in the UK, where you copied the artist, pretended you were them, and they sold it at budget price. But these albums are now extremely collectible, these albums we did, and it included Roger Odell on drums and Bill sometimes, because they were all session players, so we all knew each other. So that's how the sort of incestuous meetings got together. Everyone knew everyone. So when a vocalist was needed for this idea of some jazz funk, I was around. I was there in the studio. So that's how, Shepherd started brewing,
It's interesting you mentioned those records. So in South Africa at the time, there was apartheid. So there, obviously there was sanctions. So the artists wouldn't have their stuff played. So then local artists would do the cover versions of their songs, and it would be on a pop shop number one. And but we were thinking that it was the real artist.
That's exactly it. I mean, it was an eternal disappointment to people that bought it, because I mean, they used to cost £1. They were 99p, and they always had a picture of a woman on the front,
Yes, in a
half dressed.
costume.
It must
Dressed in
be
a
the same
costume.
sort of thing, right? Yeah,
Yes.
but your thing is, though, all those sessions were done live with orchestras, and you'd walk in the morning, and I'd be singing Donna Summer or something, or Debbie Harry, and everything had to go down live. It was a union agreement, so you do like 12 tracks a day, and you needed to know your stuff. So for me, and of course Roger and everyone involved, it's serious homework, which a lot of bands don't get a chance to do anything like that anymore. That's an apprenticeship and a half.
Wow. So like you had to do 12 different genres of type of songs in one day, in one take.
In one take, because there was a full string section and brass section, and they didn't like to be overdubbed because the union says you can only play this song once, and if you dub the orchestra again, then they get double money. So we just have to fiddle around with things,
So they don't want to pay extra.
So sometimes, I mean, there's a little bit of skullduggery went on, but yeah, it literally was. I remember doing the Carpenters calling up because, what was that, Interplanetary, with the full orchestra up and everything, thinking, I must not mess this up. And it's so nerve-wracking because you're in this booth with all the whole orchestra outside. It's a wake-up call, and it was a fantastic experience to be able to get into the voice. And people like ABBA at the time, their songs sounded so simple, but when you broke it down, you're doing all the vocals and everything about it. It was work of art, all these layers and double tracking, and of course, everything in that time contributes to everything I do now. It's just invaluable.
You mentioned ABBA, so I remember watching a documentary that Agnetha and Frida have, I think if I'm correct, they have a 4-octave range, both of them. So he got them to sing, and people think that they're quite simple songs, but when you actually, like you said, construct them, they're very, very difficult and extraordinary.
And of course, Agnetha, when they're singing something like Dancing Queen, this is what it's full voice. There's no head voice, no soprano. There's no head voice, falsetto is what I'm looking for. It's full singing, and she's got a really high register. And of course, you had to do it like that, and then track it, and then I had to be Frida as well, and then track it. And honestly, when we did albums of ABBA, the whole album, like Top of the Pops sings ABBA, Top of the Pops sings The Summer, The Pops sings Manhattan Transfer, and that. So it was a vast amount of work, well paid as well for the time. But as I say, I don't think you could get a better experience than that.
I'm sure it allowed you to learn music quickly. Do you agree?
Unfortunately, I don't read music. My mu reading music skills are pretty rough. And fortunately, the band leader that did all these things could tolerate that because I have a good ear and I could learn things quite quickly. But do sometimes if they had like three girls come in and they just turn up and read, the dots, I think, wow, no, and they were good at that. Towards the end, when it got quite complicated, it needed to be done quicker. We got backing vocalists in, but yeah, no, I don't read music very well, so it's pretty challenging.
Okay, so let's get back to Shack Attack. So you joined the guys. Why the name Shack Attack?
Well, because I remember before, you know, carrying on from the sessions, when we'd done this Shack Attack-y idea that was initiated by Nigel Wright, who was a part of the band as well, part of the Nicky North band. And he had this, he'd been to the States. He said, there's this great new movement coming along, it, suggesting the sort of music that, you know, we might give it some writing a try and get into a demo. And the demo was creating a lot of interest, you know, because it went out as a white label all over the UK.
Okay.
So they're saying, who is this band? And we didn't have a name. So one of the companies that were helping us put the records out to the DJs was the Record Shack in London. So I think it was Roger said, well, Shack is great, Shack. And I don't know who thought of the attack, but the Record Shack were responsible for the name, the beginning part.
Okay.
And the attack came with it. So it was a record shop that helped us.
Oh, well, that's interesting. From that journey from joining to the journey of Shack Attack, how has it evolved? Why do you still enjoy doing it? Let's dive into that world.
To be honest with you, it evolved through us being session players. That literally was it. We didn't all get together, and it was masterminded by Nigel Wright, who knew us all as session players, and he had an inkling of what was going on in the industry, and it was his idea, and it was down to Roger suggesting we bring Bill into the fold because he was working a lot with Bill. And Nigel, I was working with a girl called Jackie Raw doing sessions. She did some vocals with me with Shack Attack as well. So that evolved through these cover sessions and through the work we were doing as session players. And then it got to a point where we thought, well, we need a bass player who's not one of the session players.
Yes.
So because things were getting a little serious, I thought, hold on, let's try and think about the act here, because the record was gaining momentum. Mm-hmm. And of course, then we got auditioned George in, and it felt more like a unit. And of course, you know, he was a different type of player. He had this Brit funk, jazz funk vibe, and that seemed to work. And it evolved quicker than I could have ever imagined. You know, I thought that the rise up was incredibly lucky and very quick myself. And at that time, I was just a backing vocalist anyway. I wasn't formally a member of the band. The guys were the hardcore of the band, and I was just doing backing vocals with Jackie, you know, and I was there the whole time.
Yeah.
They hired me. But I was watching from afar, and I was still doing a lot of other work for other people. But I was in the studio with the guys putting down some ideas, and I do remember listening to it, thinking to myself, I'm going to stay with this. I'm not going to go and do any more sessions for anybody else. I've just got a feeling in my tummy, this boat is sailing and I need to be on it. I've been waiting a long time, and I really did. I really knew it was happening. I knew it was going to happen.
So I think if you didn't maybe pitch up for all of them, you would have possibly have been involved more, do you think?
In the beginning, in the beginning, it was primarily an instrumental. If you listen to our other tracks, it was mainly instrumental with embellished vocal, you know, just a few bits of vocal. That was the idea initially that Nigel had, to get this sort of, you know, this funky with just distant vocals. So there was no room for me to be predatory in the beginning. I just sort of laid low and did what they wanted me to do. But then, of course, there were so many years, 2 or 3 years of the instrumental. It was quite a while till we introduced a vocal into the stage show. And that's when it changed a bit. That's when I became muscled
why
in.
Why the choice to introduce voice? What was the inspiration behind that?
Well, we were reluctant. They were reluctant at first because, apart from taking off in the UK, the actual beginning of Shack Attack was gathering momentum, we discovered that it also become like wildfire in Japan. And obviously, there's no language issues. The first album was very heavy with just a few lines of English that the Japanese understood. Mm-hmm. So we were very reluctant to change that formula. But after 3 or 4 albums in, it was starting to sound a bit dinky dinky piano and here comes the singing. So we, you know, I think the record company said, yeah, let's move on a little bit. And we're always aware of that. And by the time we got in 2 or 3 albums, we were having problems. Jackie Raw wanted to leave because she was doing a lot of real big sessions for other people. Mm. We tried a few other girl singers and there were problems with the girls, and girls don't generally want to stand there and be a backing vocalist. They want to do something. So a lot of them got dissatisfied with that situation and left. And I remember Roger or Bill saying, you know, just we've got to track it. Jill, you go and do it, and we'll see how it goes, and we may not bother getting somebody else. And we did a song called Dark is the Night. Dark is the Night, it was just me. And then that was really successful. We weren't sure how it would go.
Yeah.
So that obviously it was still an instrumental vocal, but it was a solo vocal. So after that hit, it was decided, well, just carry on with just Jill. And if we need to do a big tour, we'll get two extra backing vocal singers.
Yeah.
And keep it as a main five piece, you know. And that's what happened.
So you just stuck around in the background until you could take foreground.
Yeah, I was never a pushy, but you know, when I did get the opportunity, I was ready for it. Definitely.
Exactly. But I mean, just being there was, you know, they looked at you and said, okay, Jill's, yeah, let's do it. Compared to if you weren't there all the time, then they might have thought of someone else. Or
absolutely. Yeah. Well, we did have guest vocalists on the album. So lots of vocalists that, you know, that were ready, but not really interested in the band. But I just had a feeling.
Yeah.
You know, I've been in, like you say, my history goes back to when I'm 15 years old. I've got intuition, things happening, and I stuck with it. I really did know it was going to be something. I didn't want to miss it, you know.
Exactly, yeah. So then you focus on it and manifest it. There we go.
Yeah, that's it.
That couple of years when it was just instrumental, were you doing the singing parts or?
Yeah. I was singing. On stage, I play percussion mainly as well, which is great. And I enjoy the percussion. I've got congas and timbales and stuff, because otherwise you're standing around just, picking your fingers. So I thought, I want to play conga. And I enjoyed it. Tambourines, and we all played bits and that. And that helped, because the instrumentals in those days, they used to be quite, the show was quite long, and the instrumentals were long too. And in-depth musical band didn't have much variety, lead vocals and things at that point. So I was glad that I could do something else.
So did the other backing singers also do instruments, or were they just standing there waving their arms?
They were waving arm jobs. I think Jackie had a few tambourines and things and stuff. No, but I bought a kit of congas. I'd always played congas. I played congas and that infusion. I just thought I bought a better set of congas. It looked better. And it was nice. And I still hide behind them today. They're lovely. They hide everything.
So when you guys decided to start using voice in the songs, how did that creative process come to be? Was it all you writing the music lyrics together, or was it someone else? And is that still happening currently today?
As I say, Dark is the Night was the first toe in the water, really, the vocal situation. And after that, that was accepted graciously. And the guy suggested, what about doing a proper song? Let's see how Polydor, the record company, would take that. You know, now people know that Jill's out front doing something. And we took that, and that, you know, the rest is history. It was like, wow, okay. And it was a huge hit. And there was a visual point, you know, there's Bill. It was, all of a sudden there was, oh, the blonde girl in Shack Attack, the blonde girl that wears the outrageous skin tight clothes. That was a good move. That added to the whole kudos of Shack Attack. We still kept the instrumentals. We still kept the vocal numbers dispersed, and it kind of works. That took it onto another leg. So what was the second half of your question? I remember the first half about how it got into it.
Are you guys still creating music currently? And is the process the same as
when you... Oh, my goodness me. Yeah. Well, and at that point, actually, I did come up with a couple of ideas songwriting wise. So that opened another gate, because George did a bit of writing, and I suggested on one of the albums, Down the Street album, I think it was, I've got this little song, you know, how about this? And producer Brent Nigel said, wow, love this. So that was foot in the door, barraging through the door. I was thrilled, you know, I got a song on the album. And of course, after that, everybody, you know, the rest of the band go, well, why can't we all have songs on the album? It's all right. But it's always the band. We keep the writing, the five of us, as it was then. It gives it another lease of life. You know, there's another angle. When we all think it's over, it keeps starting again. And that's what was happening. It was enough starting down another road, you know.
It's a journey, not a destination. So,
yeah. Exactly. Well, that's what they say about secretaries. Well, you're a secretary. Secretaries spend their life traveling and never arriving.
I agree with that. But sometimes I'm 6 months ahead of the rest of the world and wondering why no one's caught up to me yet.
Yeah. Well, I'm there with you.
What do you enjoy about still performing live? What is an inspiration to keep getting back on that stage?
You know, if I knew that, I just can't explain it. And I was talking to my partner about that, because I just arrived back from some shows in the UK. And I don't know what's happening here. It seems since COVID, there's a new lease of life in the audience, there's a freshness.
Yes.
And I think that's where you're going. I think having new material dispersed in the show, every so often we put a new number in. We're creating new albums all the time. You know, every 2 or 3 years, we're still with a major label, JVC, and they still put out fine albums. And that's what keeps it fresh. If there wasn't the JVC interest and JVC releases, so we'd end up just being a tribute band playing our own stuff, hits band. And we've avoided that. We've done a few shows in the past that have been, you know, where you just go through the hits, 80s nights and stuff, but we've managed to avoid an awful lot of them. And that keeps us fresh too, because every gig we do, we say, well, should we do this number that we did in 1985? And yeah, let's give it a go. And suddenly, wow, that works.
Yeah.
And that keeps it fresh.
You've got such a great repertoire of work. So every tour, when you're creating a new tour, you say, okay, we can add that song from there, that song from there. These are popular songs. Mix it up.
Yeah. Or get the audience to, because we have a huge following on Facebook and all the social platforms. And we interact with the fans a lot, you know, because that's what you do now, isn't it? And there's a lot of people said, you know, once you get 5 or 6 people tied up, well, I remember this song, da 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 da. And I'll listen to it and think, I've listened to this guy. Should we do that? I mean, the perfect example of that was the last Japan tour last year. Somebody had mentioned a song called My Utopia. And we had never played it in our lives and that. And I thought, well, I'll have a listen to it. When I listened to it, I went, oh, this is excellent. It was so Japanese. It's ding, 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 ding. It's just got a Japanese vibe. And it's like, you immediately put your hands up in the air and that. So we tried it, and there wasn't an awful lot of enthusiasm in the band to do it. Well, give it a go. And then Bill is so good on stage, and he said, you know, we're not sure about this, but it's a number that a lot of fans have asked about. And somebody had mailed me for the lyrics, and it'd been mentioned a few times. So we said, we're going to try it out on you guys tonight. And all you got to do is just enjoy it and put your hands in the air. So it started the second set. So all of a sudden, we've got 400 or 500 people. Dee, dee, dee. And at the end, it was jumping back to stay. That's still in the set.
Yeah.
I love it.
That's cool.
So that's really important. Really important.
Yeah. So that interaction and feedback from the fans so allows you to do what they want.
Yeah. Of course, it's fabulous. Fabulous. Yeah.
So I'm always a person right up front in concerts. I'm dancing, doing my thing. And I notice people around me have all got their cell phones out trying to get the perfect picture, perfect video, what all they're posting or tweeting. From the person on the other side of that, seeing all the phones instead of the faces and interactions, does that bother you, or is it just where society is today?
It bothers me, because as a woman, you know, when they're standing at the side of the stage and or they're standing looking up your nose, and you know it's going to go on YouTube. I know it sounds vain. You see it on YouTube, or you see it on Facebook, and you think, oh, my God, I look awful. And why didn't they just show, and we'll get somebody professional to film it and make us look good? Everyone moans about, you know, like Bill, he can't stand having that side done. You know, so-and-so doesn't like that side. And of course, the audience, they get you raw, and it never looks good.
Yeah.
It's horrible. So when I see the cameras on it, oh, no. No.
Do you feel that allows a disconnect with the audience as well? That the energy separation?
Sometimes, yeah, sometimes. We have a real ardent group of fans, and they call themselves, they say they're Egyptian gypsies, and they've come to see us in Germany in droves, and they're fabulous. Mm. They go crazy. Fabulous, fabulous audience. But they don't watch the show. Everything, they go to the corner of the stage and they're filming Bill's hands and that. They don't turn the phones off, so I don't know how they can enjoy the show, but they go berserk. But every time it's just filmed.
Yeah. It's interesting, because if you're looking through the phone, it's the same as looking at you through a TV, whereas your real life right there, 10 feet away, and they're still looking through their phones. It's just so frustrating.
Yeah, I know. Really crazy still. I don't know. Maybe if it was Stevie Wonder and I was at the front of the stage, maybe I'd be filming it too. Who knows?
Pre to me doing Celeb Savant, I never used to take my phones out. Now, because I'm doing Celebs Vines, I'll take my phone, but I'm like, okay, 2 video clips, couple of photos, then put it away and let it go.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm very strict.
Let it go.
Let it go.
Let it go.
So back in the day, we had CDs, vinyls, cassettes. They're all making a massive comeback, gratefully. I'm not sure if you're aware that last year alone, there were 5.5 million vinyls sold in the UK, the biggest since 1990. And they're all making a comeback, but they're also these streaming platforms that people listen to music on. What are your thoughts about people's consumption of music now compared to what it was like before?
My feelings are mixed. Obviously, we are suffering at the hands of Spotify and various other companies. From a songwriting point of view, it's a disaster. Everything I've worked for, writing my work is out there free, and I didn't expect that when I, at the end of my career, I didn't expect everybody to have everything free. And there's nothing you can do about that. And I'm not sure I'm clued up enough. A lot of new acts know how to milk it a different way. With their platforms, products, and whatever it is. Because I've got two sons that tell me, you're not doing it right. That's why you're not earning your money, So it's a different world now. It's a different music world, and we're just not on it enough. But we try and grit our teeth and put up the fact that our music has to be there. There's no point taking it off Spotify because nobody will listen to us. The good thing about it is the online sales. The streaming sales. I mean, we still get healthy record sales accounts every quarter, and think, wow, what is this? The people are buying our product, and that makes up for it because buying albums the sales were dwindling. And on the note about the albums, that our new album is coming out in November. Printing, I think it's five. We're having 500 special vinyl copies done, just of a select few numbers on it.
Yes.
So we are going into vinyl. We're going
Yay.
Back.
You'll see an artist put a post on their social media. They had 500 million downloads.
Yeah.
Like, what they don't tell the audience that they only got like $1,000 or something like that. So the listening audience think they're making a fortune. They don't realize that the artists are not coping with it.
It's good for the audience in a way. I mean, the audience, a win-win situation, because what happens is that they get the music free, and because the bands are so stifled financially, there are more live bands on the road. And that's why there's so many bands from our era, probably saw your future as retired living in Hollywood somewhere, fortune, and suddenly, there's no residuals, there's no money anymore. I better get my ass out there and tour. And that's why there's so many bands on the road that you're quite surprised in it. What are they touring for? Didn't they make some money? And the answer is it has brought a sudden stop in the industry to songwriters. Your work is, we're all prostitutes. We're prostitute paid. It's paid, isn't it? But no, we're not even that. We're just charity.
I still buy myself CDs. I find it as a thank you to you guys for the hard work you do. I don't feel music should be free. There should be some energy exchange. So there's definitely a disconnect that's happening and needs to change somehow. So we'll have to see how that progresses.
It needs to be modified. I just noticed that Spotify are putting up their subscriptions to their punters. A big hike is coming. And I think, okay, well, we don't see anything. So where's this hike? Where does it leave us? Probably nowhere.
So speaking of songs, I know if I had to ask you this question in 3 days, 3 hours, 3 months, I know your answer will be different every time I ask you this question. But if you had to push play to 5 songs by other artists once we were finished talking, what would those songs be and by whom?
The first is easy, this one. The first one, number one on my all-time list that just personifies everything about music is After the Love Has Gone, Earth, Wind & Fire. For me, it encapsulates everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's my holy Bible song. That one, number one. Okay. The second one would be Isley Brothers, Highways of My Life, purely because it was at a time where there were several roads showing, and I'm thinking, what do I see? Do I leave it to the left or the right? Whatever the words are. It's all very personal. And number three would be I Love Your Smile for when I had my children, when I had my son. Cute songs took on a different meaning, when you're looking at baby and also when I had him, I was in Japan touring and my heart was broken because I left my baby at home. And every time I heard that song, I imagined his smile. So it's all cheesy.
It's perfect. It's experiences. Two more songs.
Laura Nyro, going way, way back. Let's Car for the Poverty Train.
Okay.
It was another momentous moment because I was starting out, as a singer. It suddenly occurred to me that women could write songs. I'd never heard of that. And also the final, well, we have five, isn't that? But the next one is Carole King.
Okay.
You've Got a Friend. Same sort of thing, that era of women.
Yes.
And vocally for me, Wild is the Wind, Barbra Streisand, for a vocal performance, which is timeless and with full orchestra, purely because that's what I'd like to do one day. I'd love to do a track like that.
I love it. I'm going to add them to my list. So The podcast is listened to throughout the world. As a final message to the listening audience, what would you like to say?
Well, world, you know, we try and get around the world as much as we can, all around the world tonight, which is the name of our last album. A lot of destinations we haven't reached yet, and just give us strength and hope that we can carry on for another 40 years. God, that'd be funny. So that we can discover the rest of the world, i.e. the United States and so many places we're yet to visit, we're hoping. So, world, we will get there in the end, I promise you.